Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
If you'd like to turn in your Bibles to Nehemiah 13, that's where we're going to begin in a few moments. Nehemiah 13, as we continue our series, Thinking About Life After the Exile, and thinking about what happened in the lives of leaders like Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah. This is a great day for us to be together, not just to worship, but we look forward to a lot of fellowship that's taking place. We're excited about many of our children in our children's classes who participated in a toy drive and were taught giving by being able to share what they had given and what they had set aside to donate with some other children. We're thankful for that, all those who took part in that. And there have been a lot of people getting ready for Snacks with Santa, and we always look forward to times like that. It's good for us just to have times as a congregation to be together and to grow in those kinds of relationships. I've noticed that several of our Bible classes have planned times this month to meet outside of class time, just to spend time together, and that's always a wonderful thing. I know we had, I think, about 140 signed up for our senior adult Christmas party this past week, and we're thankful that that went well and that they had a chance to make those same kinds of connections. As we grow and as we grow closer to each other, we grow stronger as a church family. And so those things are so important, and we want to keep those in mind. We also want to continue to keep in mind those who are struggling right now, and see ways we can encourage them. We want to think about the year to come as we plan our calendar. If you have something you're in charge of in 2015, please let us know so we can get that on the church calendar. As I said in our class today, the calendar always brings with it a couple of mysteries. One is what the ministry theme for 2015 will be. We'll kind of unveil that at the beginning of the year. And the other mystery is which major event in 2015 will I put in the wrong place on the calendar? And so, in previous years it's been camp, and it might be giveaway day. Who knows? You've got to show up to get those calendars to find out. We know we'll have to make some changes, but we want to get as much information there as possible so that those can be as helpful as they possibly can. One of the first things that'll be on the calendar is the College Age 20-something retreat that'll be on January 2nd through the 4th. Please see Terry Stewart for more details on that. I'm so glad that he's taking the leadership and getting a retreat like that together. We're thankful for that group. One of the things we've been doing on Sunday night are learning some songs that might be newer to us. And one of these that I think we've sung before but haven't sung in a while is You're Worthy of My Praise. And here you can see that the guys start out and the ladies echo. And so if you know it, sing out. If not, it's easy to catch on to, and we'll sing it through a couple of times as some of us will be learning it for maybe the first or second time. I will worship with all of my heart. I will praise you with all of my strength. I will seek you all of my days. I will follow all of your ways, all your ways. I will give you all my worship. I will give you all my praise. You alone I long to worship. You alone are worthy of my praise. Let's go back to the first verse and we'll start that over again. As you see, ladies, it's very similar to the guy's part. There's just that little part at the end that's different. But again, we'll sing through as we learn this together. I will worship with all of my heart. I will praise you with all of my strength. I will seek you all of my days, and I will follow all of your ways, all your ways. I will give you all my worship. I will give you all my praise. You alone I long to worship. You alone are worthy of my praise. I will bow down and hail you as King. I will serve you, give you everything, and I will lift up my eyes to your throne. I will trust you. I will trust you alone. Trust you alone. I will give you all my worship. I will give you all my praise. You alone I long to worship. You alone are worthy of my praise. We'll continue to learn that one together, but it's a beautiful way for us to focus on praise. We're also very excited to have our group from Happy Haven here. We're thankful to get to partner with them and to have gotten to know them. And so I know you'll look forward to many in our youth group that have been able to go over there, and others that have been there. We'll look forward to making some new connections and sort of reconnecting with some of the individuals that you met. In Nehemiah chapter 13, we come to the end to the book of Nehemiah, and in many ways, the things that we have gone over have been a little unfamiliar to us. We've looked at cultures that were unfamiliar. We've looked at people speaking different languages and talk of building walls and cities, and that's just a little different than the culture in which we live. But what we see in Nehemiah chapter 13 is something that is very, very familiar to us. When we last left Nehemiah, he and Ezra had stood up in Nehemiah chapter 8, and they had had the six-hour reading of the law where the people stood up listening to God's word. And in the chapters after that one, chapters 9 and 10, the people rededicate themselves to fulfilling the law of God. People began weeping because they saw where they had fallen short. They thought through the specific changes that had to be made. In fact, several of those are found in Nehemiah chapter 10. The recommitments and rededications they make. And it might seem like this is a point where Nehemiah can go back right into the sunset. Everything can be going well and he's got God's people back on the right track. But that's not exactly what happens. It's not exactly what happens in Nehemiah 13. I thought it was interesting in the last few years to read accounts and transparency of some big named celebrities and sports stars. One of those you may be familiar with was Josh Hamilton, the first player taken in the 99 baseball draft. He had a bright future ahead of him. And after playing in the minor leagues for a while, he was involved in a car accident, and during that time, he began abusing drugs and alcohol. He continued to play in the minors. He began showing up late for practice, failed the drug test, finally was cut, and for a couple of years didn't play professional sports of any kind. After several attempts at rehab, he finally got back on track. And I remember a few years ago, what took place in 2009, as he began sort of experiencing some success. He was very open in interviews about a brief relapse that took place. A website published photos of him in a bar, and all of a sudden it was clear from the pictures and the comments that he'd been drinking. He came forward and said this to the press. He said, obviously, it was one of those things that reinforced I can't have alcohol. I got away from the one thing that kept me on the straight and narrow, and that was my relationship with the Lord. That should always come first. Hopefully some good will come out of this. It just crossed my mind that night. Can I have a drink? Obviously I can't, and this reinforces that. Since that night, I've not had another thought like that. I know it's something I shouldn't do because it leads to other things. The reason I bring this up is because all of us can relate to the sinking feeling of realizing we've done something that we know we shouldn't have done, and what's going to happen next. Because that's what happens with God's people in Nehemiah chapter 13. We come to them and realize they have done things that they know they shouldn't have done. Before we read these verses in Nehemiah chapter 13, I just want to look back on a couple of things that happened in chapter 10. Listen to some of the statements Judah made when the law is restored in chapter 10. Verse 39 of chapter 10, they said, "We will not neglect the house of our God." They were going to make sure they took care of the temple. In verse 37, they were going to make sure they restored the practice in the law of Moses of tithing, of giving a tenth of what you had and the first fruits of what you had. And they said in verse 37, "We will bring the first of our dough, our contributions, the fruit of every tree, the new wine and the oil to the priests at the chambers of the house of our God, and the tithe of our ground to the Levites, for the Levites are they who receive the tithes in all the rural towns." They understood that the Levites were living from those offerings. That's the way God had designed it. They decided they were going to keep the Sabbath. Chapter 10 and verse 31 says, "As for the peoples of the land who bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or a holy day. We will forego the crops the seventh year and the exaction of every debt." They're putting their practice back in line with what they'd read from the law of God. And in verse 30, they say, "We will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons." Intermarriage with other nations was a concern that we see several times in the law of Moses, primarily because it was that intermarriage with other nations that would keep Israel from truly serving God. And so all those statements have been made in chapter 10, and it seems like just the span of a few pages in our Bibles to chapter 13, but we find out in chapter 13 that there was a period of time which Nehemiah wasn't there. That he had been away. We don't know exactly what that period of time was, what that length of time was. It may have been 1 or 2 years. It may have been longer than that. But when he comes back, he finds things are very different. And notice, we're just going to read a few of these verses and then think through some of the relapses that had taken place. Now, before this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, and who was related to Tobiah, prepared for Tobiah a large chamber where they had previously put the grain offering, the frankincense, the vessels, and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil, which were given by the commandment to the Levites, singers and gatekeepers, and the contribution for the priests. While this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king, and after some time I asked leave of the king and came to Jerusalem. And then I discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And notice Nehemiah's response in verse 8. "And I was very angry, and I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I gave orders, and they cleansed the chambers, and I brought back there the vessels of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. I also found out that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled each to his field." Notice what else he discovers. "So I confronted the officials and said, 'Why is the house of God forsaken?' And I gathered them together and set them in their stations. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain, wine, and oil into the storehouses. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouses Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, and Pedaiah of the Levites, and as their assistant, Hanan son of Zachar, son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable, and their duty was to distribute to their brothers. Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for his service." Now, I realize there are a lot of names in that passage. And that's an extended reading as Nehemiah is giving details about what's taking place. But I want us to realize that this is not a foreign concept to us. The idea of relapsing back into the life I used to live and the way I used to be and maybe things that seem a little more comfortable is just as current as a comment made by a baseball player who says, you know, one day I just had the thought, what if I did this? What if I just went back to living the way I had done? What if I just kind of went back to the kind of lifestyle I had? What would that be like? And you think about that long enough and play with it in your mind. And what if just this once I fill in the blank? And we know what can happen. It's natural. And so I want us to think through the reforms here that Nehemiah makes when he comes back into town and see if there aren't some applications for us in our lives. The first thing we find out about in that passage that had to be restored was the temple. Now again, to us, this has been a theme that's come all the way through Nehemiah. We've talked about the temple over and over again and the importance of the temple. But when Nehemiah came back, he found out something very interesting and you might even have thought unlikely had happened. There was an individual named Tobiah that had a room in the temple. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's because we've seen in the book of Nehemiah that Tobiah was an opponent of Nehemiah. That when Nehemiah was trying to build the wall, Tobiah was one of those that was trying to discourage him. And yet, he had sort of worked his way into the people of God so that he had a room in the temple. He was the son-in-law of a Judean named Shechaniah, and his son had married a Jewish girl. And Nehemiah 6 and verse 18 says that some in Judah were bound by an oath to him. So he had kind of this family connection. And so even though he's opposing Nehemiah building the wall and shouting out this opposition, he's also sort of working his way in to the people. And the high priest at the time, Eliashib, was apparently related to Tobiah, and he allowed him to use the room that had previously been set aside for the items that would have sustained the Levites. You may remember that the Levites were the tribe that were specifically focused on serving in the temple. That was their job. And so while other tribes would have had places where they worked and farmed and did other things, the Levites specifically were to be sustained by what came into the temple. It was the way that God had designed it. But apparently, Tobiah had slid in to the area where the Levites had stayed, and now they weren't there, and he was. And his presence indicates that they had stopped providing for the Levites as they should have. And even though he's related to Eliashib, and even though he has these family relations, he was an Ammonite. In other words, he was from another country, from another nationality. And we're reminded that as part of the law of Moses, that was against the rule. The temple was for God's chosen people. So what had happened was they had allowed someone to sort of come in and take up residence. He was an enemy. He was an opponent. From the very beginning, Nehemiah chapter 2 is when we first run into him. He's mocking the wall, planning with others to cause a disturbance in chapter 4, sending letters to try to frighten him, and Nehemiah trying to scare him away from his work. And yet somehow he had gotten room in the temple. Now, before we stop and think, how is that even possible? How could they allow someone like that to come into the temple? It seems like they had allowed that to happen because they hadn't been doing what they should have been doing. Rather than supporting the Levites, giving what they had in order to support them, there was room for him to sort of slide in. I think I see a parallel here when Paul writes to the church at Ephesus in Ephesians chapter 4. In verse 26, when he says, "Be angry and yet do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and do not give the devil an opportunity." Your translation may say, "Do not give the devil a place or a foothold." The imagery is if we give just a little foothold, a little place for Satan just to sort of sink in his fingers and to try to take hold in our lives, that can grow exponentially. Satan is looking for a way in to our lives. And even if we think we've got things under control, it's sometimes easy to sort of compartmentalize things. And maybe just have one compartment. Maybe there's this one part of my life I won't totally change. And I might do everything else, but you know, there's one area I owe this to myself, and it's okay for me to do this. And whatever rationalizations we can come up with might allow just a little bit of a foothold, a little bit of a place. Did you notice how angry Nehemiah was when he saw what had happened? He knew what would take place if they allowed this presence to stay in the temple. The temple had to be restored. And if I'm thinking about my own life, I might need to look at my life and say, is there anything in my life that needs to be cast out? I'm not talking about anything being cast out in a miraculous way, but is there something in my life that I need to say, it needs to leave? I've allowed this to happen, and now it needs to be different. The temple had to be restored. And another practice in the Old Testament, tithing, the tithes had to be restored. We've mentioned that a couple of times. This is something under the law of Moses that was very important. The term literally means one-tenth. According to the old law, they would give one-tenth of their crops, herds, etc. Now, based on what we know about the other sacrifices they were to make, it really, in the Old Testament, didn't just stop at one-tenth. They likely gave much more of that, but at least a tenth was sort of the baseline, and we see tithes referred to more than once. In fact, in Numbers chapter 18, verse 21, here's what God says that the Levites, this tribe that was supporting Israel in their worship to God, was to do. He said to the sons of Levi, I have given all the tithe in Israel for an inheritance in return for the service which they perform, the service of the tent of meeting. In other words, everybody's giving a tithe, and that tithe is going to support the tribe of Levi, who rather than being out and working during the day, are working before the people, before the Lord. They're in the tent of meeting. They're helping in their service to God that He had designed. And so the Levites would give a tithe of what they received, and then they would live off everything else. And so before Nehemiah left, the Israelites had the portion set aside that they needed to. The end of chapter 12 tells us that. They'd promised that they wouldn't neglect the temple. But something had happened. There had been some kind of breakdown. And all of a sudden, when Nehemiah comes back, the Levites don't have anything to live on. And so what happened? If they don't have anything to live on, they've got to go out to their fields. They've got to work in order to be able to feed themselves. And so God's plan had broken down because they'd stopped doing what God asked. It's interesting to me that sin usually works that way, doesn't it? When we start compromising in one area, then there are other areas that follow. And pretty soon, I didn't think I would ever get over here, but because I started here, and I had to do this to make up for what I'm doing here, and then I had to cover up with this, I've got complications in my life, and I have got a stack of issues that are before me, all because of something that seemed to start very small. Maybe not tithing didn't seem like a very big deal. But whatever had happened in the time Nehemiah had left, it slowly began to build. And it had gotten to a breaking point when he came back. And so if they're not tithing and Tobiah is now in the temple, where are things headed? And so he appoints people who are trustworthy and says, we're going to restore this. I wonder sometimes what might happen in my life. If I stop doing one thing, might it lead to something else? In other words, if I decide, you know, I need something, and so I'm just going to deceive someone just this once in order to get something that needs to happen. Maybe even I've got good intentions, but I'm just going to lie this one time, maybe a couple times. And in order to support that lie, I might have to do something else that's not very good. But this is the only time, and maybe over here I'm going to have to make this change, but I promise this is the only time that's going to happen. And we rationalize these things, and yet it continues to grow and continues to stack up, and maybe before we know it, we're failing in more than one area. And so if I'm looking at my own life critically, I'm going to have to ask, what needs to be restored? We also find out that for the people of Israel, the Sabbath needed to be restored. For the tribes of Judah here, they needed to put the Sabbath back in its proper place. It's taken from a word that just means cease in Hebrew, a cessation day. We see this all the way back and all through the Old Testament, a day in which God's people did not work. It provided this rhythm of rest. You would work and then you would rest. And it wasn't just about rest. It was about honoring God, remembering God. It provided a rhythm to their life. But they'd forgotten the Sabbath. They were treading wine presses. They were bringing in loads of food. And maybe that started out small as well. And maybe it was just one or two people who were selling things on the Sabbath. And maybe something small started, but by the time Nehemiah gets back, they've forgotten about it. Now, Jesus has to deal with, later on, those who've gone to the other extreme. Those who valued their rules about the Sabbath more than they even valued the God who created the Sabbath. And so it's always good for us to be reminded of what Jesus says in Mark 2 and verse 27. The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Some people Jesus were dealing with had made the Sabbath into an idol. But here, years and years and years earlier, Nehemiah is dealing with people who'd forgotten about the Sabbath altogether. They'd said one thing, but they had gotten to where it just wasn't that big a deal for them. You've probably never done this before, but when it gets to the end of the year, sometimes I look back and I think about decisions I made at the beginning of the year. Decisions like, I'm going to do this regularly. I'm going to do this three times a week. Maybe I'm going to exercise this much. I'm going to make these changes in my budget and my spending. I'm going to make this change to my lifestyle or that change at work. Or I'm going to start doing this differently. And it can be a little bit depressing to look back and to think, did I really accomplish what I set out to accomplish? The changes in life that are worth making are often hard to make and sometimes even harder to sustain. And so the people were ready to make a change when they heard the word of God. The tears that they shed weren't fake. Those were real emotions. They really wanted to make that change, but something had happened over time. And so, yes, this is about the temple and about tithing and about the Sabbath, but it's also about something all of us deal with, isn't it? The temptation to say, well, is this really that important? It's interesting to see that this, as an identity marker for God's people, was vital. Now, the Sabbath itself isn't carried over in the New Covenant. We don't see early Christians practicing that. We see them setting aside the Lord's Day, setting aside Sunday as a day of worship, and yet for many of them, they had to work that day. That wasn't a day off work as it is for many today. They would often have to work and then meet later to carve out time to make sure they could worship that day. But that principle is still important, isn't it? Building time into our schedules and into our lives to rest and reflect on the God that we serve. What would some other identity markers of Christians be? This was an identity marker of God's people then. If you had to make your own list of identity markers for God's people, what would it include? Would joy be on the list? Aren't God's people supposed to be joyful? Should our behavior be on the list? Aren't the ways in which we live supposed to be different from the world around us? Would our attitudes be on the list? The way we look at life, our perspectives of how we deal with others? Would our language be on the list? Would that be an identity marker where if people hear us speaking and hear the words we use and even the things that we say, they'd be able to realize there was something different? They had to restore the Sabbath. And we also see something that is, again, a concern we see several times in the Old Testament. They had to restore their marriages. As we read in chapter 10, they were wanting to make sure that they did not intermarry with the surrounding nations. And I want us to be careful in understanding that this was not a prejudice that was there because of a different race or a different nationality. This was a spiritual issue. The concern here is spiritual. And we even see, if we look at Ezra and Nehemiah, and then you look at Ruth, and the importance that Ruth plays in not only the life of God's people, but in the lineage of Jesus. And she was from Moab. She's a Moabite. It's not a racial issue, but a faith issue. What God is concerned with are people being led astray from Him. And so Solomon had allowed his wives to turn his heart from God. It's one example we can think of. Intermarriage with other nations had diluted the faith of God's people. And so I want us to be careful when we read this that we're thinking about the Old Testament context here, the context that Nehemiah is dealing with, and the focus on faith. And maybe that causes us to ask some serious questions about not just the people that we would marry, but also the people where we spend our time with. Are they people who are going to encourage me in my faith, or do I need to make sure that I'm on guard against what might happen? Obviously, if we want to reach the world, we've got to encounter people who believe differently than us, but we also need to be thinking about those who can encourage us. There's a tension there. There's a balance to keep in mind. Rebuilding the wall was to restore a sense of identity after the exile. They'd had their names changed. They'd had their customs changed. And so Nehemiah is trying to help them restore that. By compromising their faith and marrying with other groups, they're headed back down that same path. Now, obviously, we're, again, living under the new covenant. But isn't there a principle there that when it comes to our marriages, that God is the one who would define how we need to be living in marriage? That our relationships would be defined by God? We live in a world where relationships and marriage is in a state of flux. Even the definition of marriage is being debated in many places. We understand what Scripture says about a man and a woman who are married, living together. But at the same time, even at a more basic level than that, what does our culture say about the marriage relationship if we're flipping through TV channels? Are there a lot of examples of loving spouses that go the extra mile for each other that we see on TV? Or is there a lot more cynicism and sarcasm and sort of looking to get the other person back for something, or maybe have just the right comment rather than caring about what a person says, just something sarcastic that could get a laugh? Isn't that an image we see around us? An image of husbands and wives that might not care about communicating with each other, or might not care as much about others in the family as much as their own needs or wants or desires. Isn't that something we see around us? Is God defining the way in which we live in our marriage relationship? In our marriages, not only will we face those kinds of temptations, but Satan is going to set other temptations our way. Are we willing to let God define our marriages? And so, even though this is a story about restoring things that might seem a little unfamiliar to us, temple and the tithes and the Sabbaths, and thinking about even the commands they had been given about marriage, and yes, we're living under the new covenant, but we're the same human beings with the same temptations, and we're dealing with the same challenge of making sure we don't ask ourselves, you know, what if I just went back to the way I used to be just for a day or two? What if just this once I made this decision? As we mentioned with the example of Josh Hamilton, he immediately regretted that. I appreciated reading a comment that was very straightforward and transparent. And we've all made decisions at times that we've looked back and immediately regretted. But there have been other decisions that maybe have led us down a path, and it wasn't until we were already a good ways down that path we turned around and said, how did I get here? And so the book of Nehemiah ends in a really interesting way. It ends with Nehemiah coming back and trying to set things back in order. It's really not the most positive, happy ending we could have expected after seeing how focused the people were on serving God. But it's a reminder of human nature. Not just of theirs, but of ours as well. And so tonight, it's good for us to stop and reflect. Are there changes that need to be made in my life? Have I sort of lapsed into a way I used to live or used to think, or ideas that have led me away from God? Is there something that needs to be changed? Nehemiah gives us the example of dealing with that head on, of not avoiding the issue, but saying, here's what needs to be different. Let's change it. And so tonight, if there's something that needs to be different in your life, please, let's change that. Allow God to give you the strength to change that. Come to Him and have brothers and sisters around you who want to encourage you and help you do the right thing. It may be that you need to become a child of God and begin living that new life. We're in a season where a lot of gifts are going to be given, and it's fun to give gifts to others, and it's fun to receive gifts, but there's no better gift that any of us could ever imagine than the gift of eternal life. And that's available to every single person here tonight. There's no reason for any of us to go home without being sure of that gift in our lives. If you need to become a child of God tonight, if there's any way we can help you, please come as we stand and as all of us sing together.